Hello, pals. Hope you are doing well and thriving as we hurtle towards November in a year that I imagine in 50 years' time, we will all be writing off in our memoirs. That is assuming that all of you are going to be writing memoirs in 50 years' time. I mean, I hate to break it to you. Some of you will be dead. And a lot of you will have better things to do with your retirement than write your memoirs. Anyway, to business. Firstly, I hope that you all enjoyed our live show last week as much as we enjoyed recording it. Thank you to each and every Patreon donor who has supported us and genuinely helped make it happen. A particular thank you to Lucy Lawson, who came all the way down from Scotland on a two-day holiday to come and see us out. In between, as she confided to me, ignoring all of London's tourist hotspots and just going to the cinema loads. Thank you also to our newest Patreon, who I believe also joined us at the show, Matthew Ramsden. A hat tip to you, sir, for helping keep the lights on here at Worst Foot Forward headquarters. I'm not going to bang this drum too loudly, but you know what to do. If you want to support us, head to patreon.com/worstfootforward, and there are all sorts of goodies there that will be uploaded. Me and Barry are going head to head with monthly challenges this year. You get the fun and games that if you start donating now, we'll be producing different content for you guys on Patreon from the start of 2022. Equally, if you are the sort of person who loves recommending podcasts to people, then I think this past week would be the time to do it. I've just listened back to the live episode today on a big drive back from the Northeast, and you know what? We were pretty funny. Our guests were pretty funny. Any audience members there, you did your jobs well. So if you want to recommend our podcast to a pal, now is the time to do it. And if some of you are thinking, oh man, I really enjoyed listening to that live show, I wish that I could see the lads live sometime soon. Well, worry not, you can. Mark the date in your diaries. Sunday, February the 20th at 2:30 p.m. at the Vault Festival in Waterloo, we are putting on our third live show. And whisper it quiet, friends, we're in a 170 capacity room. So believe you me, this is not the last you'll be hearing of it, because we're going to have a ruddy good go at selling it out. We already have one very exciting guest booked, another one emailed, and a third nervously in the pipeline. But believe you me, if we can pull the three of them off, it is going to be an astonishing show. But for the meantime, we hope that you enjoy this week's episode. Now, it is sandwiched in between two episodes that hopefully have pin-sharp clarity on the sound. Last week, because of the wonderful James Hingley on sound. Next week, because our guest, Pete Donaldson, is a professional broadcaster. This week's guest is cracking, but he, as he explains in the show, was coming to us live via his phone in Colombia. So there may be a couple of points where his audio drops out just for a second or two, but we reckon it should be fairly obvious what he was talking about, and you can fill the gaps in his sentences. Feel free to fill them with the wrong words, and you may have a more enjoyable listening experience for yourself. But just wanted to give you the heads up of that. With all that said, there are some great stories in this week's show. So pop on your white lab coat, fire up your Bunsen burners, and get ready for the world's worst chemist. Hello, friends, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find us back in the Worst Foot Forward labs, surrounded by the fizz and pop of volatile liquids, distilling our favourite rare earths into beakers and honeydews, and slyly toasting images of Jesus Christ into slices of bread on Bunsen burners. As this is episode number 229, we're currently trying to uncover the 229th element of the periodic table. Given that the current highest atomic number is held by Oganesson with 118 protons, we might be here for a while. We're not quite sure how we're going to get there, but we're pretty sure when it arrives, it's going to be called Schadenfreudium. And the moment it comes into existence, it will immediately destroy the known universe. Still, certainly worth it for the brief nanosecond of scientific immortality we both achieve. And alongside me, tearing apart the very fabric of reality until it reaches a fine powder, is the unstable isotope to my own slowly decaying element, Barry McStay.
I feel like the Peter Lorre, like, Igor character alongside you. Yes, master.
Do you honestly think that's the way around? I think you'd look far smarter.
No, let's be honest, it's probably the other way around, yeah.
Yeah, listen, we all know which part Marty Feldman played in Young Frankenstein, and whilst I can't get my eyes to rotate in different directions like he could, I think...
I can do a good quick step, though. I could probably carry off that bit.
Okay, what we've discovered is that we're both Igor.
Yeah.
that feels like a good description of us, just looking at them going, what a pair of Igors.
Yeah. I like when we go back and do science episodes, because neither of us are really scientifically minded, so...
No, not at all. Hugely enthusiastic for everything science has done for us, and big fan.
You know, teenage boys, when they lose their virginity, are hugely enthusiastic. It doesn't mean they're any good at it. In fact, they probably should stay well away.
I think you'll find that when I lost my virginity, the overriding emotion was not enthusiasm, but gratefulness.
Yeah. Relief. In more senses than one.
Unbelievable.
How have we already lowered the tone this low?
Excuse me, it was you who decided to bring that along. I was referencing one of the great works of literature from the 19th century.
Well, before we dig even deeper into the pit, let me introduce our guest. Our guest this week is an award-winning science journalist with a master's degree in pharmacy from the University of Bradford and a PhD in the history and philosophy of science from the University of Sunderland. He was previously an editor for Chemistry World. Sorry?
From the University of where?
Sunderland, Ben.
Well, that's the end of the show, I'm afraid.
Please, let's not have some northeastern beef already on the show.
Northeastern beef is amongst the most delicious and stripy of beefs available on the market.
Well, our guest was previously also an editor for Chemistry World, the periodical's periodical. And has... I'm very proud of that. And his byline can be seen in Nature, New Scientist, The Daily Telegraph, they can't all be reputable outlets, BBC Science Focus, and most excitingly of all, Chemist and Druggist, which sounds like a Backstreet version of Horse and Hound. He also appears regularly on radio, TV, and podcasts. Wow, we should get him on the show.
We should.
His first book, Super Heavy, Making and Breaking the Periodic Table, was published in 2019, and he's currently writing his second book, Racing Green, about the science of motorsport. Maybe, someday, somewhere in the distant future, we will learn exactly how make car go fast. There's currently just no way to know. He's very heavy metal, utterly fluid, and quite the gas. It's the sublime Dr. Kit Chapman.
Hello, thank you for having me. That was a hell of an introduction.
You're very welcome.
I should apologise as well for the Sunderland thing. So that was actually just to piss off my dad. I mean, that's the only reason I went to Sunderland. So he's a massive Leeds fan, and in the 70s, Leeds lost in the FA Cup final to Sunderland, and he never got over it. So just to annoy my dad, I went to the University of Sunderland.
I thought you were going to tell us your dad was a massive fan of Paracelsus, and he thought you'd go and study chemistry just to annoy him.
Oh, Paracelsus, what a dude with his homunculuses and his belief in mermaids. He was an odd chap.
Yeah. One of the friends of the show we've had on many a time. Ben is a Newcastle native, you see, so Sunderland holds a special place in whatever the opposite
He's
of his
just
heart
waiting
is.
For the oil millions to roll in so he can buy...
You'll notice that Barry phrased that sentence very carefully because I'm a Newcastle native, but regrettably no longer a Newcastle fan.
Yeah, he has resigned his commission.
What?
Hopefully temporarily. Hope.
Does that mean people are going to give you like black and white striped feathers in the street?
Good. Yeah. Yes. There's someone. What a wonderful image that is of people literally plucking magpies.
That's exactly the image that was going.
Give them feathers to me.
I don't think he can be a true Geordie, though. He's got a shirt on.
Yeah. In October, I know. It's practically Mediterranean outside in Newcastle terms. Speaking of that, you're not based in the UK anymore.
No, I'm sort of roaming around the world. So I'm in Colombia. I'm in Santa Marta at the moment. I've been trying to find El Dorado, sort of bumming around at the moment. about 2 months ago, I was in Mexico and I found myself upside down, unable to breathe, literally in the Mayan underworld. So I was diving in the cenotes, which is what they believe is sort of the entrance to hell. And I thought, this isn't good. Let's go and do something above water instead. And so I headed over to Colombia and I've been looking around Guanavita Lake in Bogota, which they believe is the source of the origins of El Dorado.
That's incredible. I mean, there's two things going on there. Firstly, you are unsurprisingly the second guest on this show to go in search of El Dorado. Also, it's incredible.
Spoiler alert, the first one didn't find it.
Yeah. And also, you said that you were in the Mayan underworld looking for the gates of hell. So that's twice you've been near the gates of hell there and at the University of Sunderland.
it's many more times than that. I have seen some odd things around the world. I mean, one of the cool things about being a science journalist is you end up in these places that people just don't know exist. So I've seen someone deactivate a nuclear bomb with a dildo, which is...
Sorry, go no further. Please explain.
Well,
did they get the mushroom cloud bit of it confused?
So, I can't tell you which country it is for obvious reasons. It's sort of security. But you go into these laboratories and you have to go through various quarantine and sort of decontamination. And then you go up and then you go down because the elevator has to be activated from the top floor. You go into the basement and you're in this incredibly secure lab. And there is a pink anal vibrator. And you think, why is that there? Now, you know, being a man of culture, I have to ask. And essentially...
as a journalist, you're duty bound to ask the hard questions.
This is nothing to do with journalism. This is 100% pure perversion. I was like, why have you got a dildo? Yeah. And so what happened was they're trying to break up plutonium. And as part of the process, they need to shake and, you know, shake their samples. And the problem is they couldn't find something that could get past the lead bricks that was able to, vibrate at the right RPM and that was nice and clean and wipeable so they could get the plutonium off. It was easy to replace. And they couldn't get a lab equipment. So, and then someone went, why don't we just go down to the sex shop? Why don't we pick up a dildo? So off someone went and they went into town. They went into the red light district. They went into the sex shop. They got their little pink bum waggler and whatnot. They came back, and this thing, they assembled it.
Isn't that a bird only found in Sussex during springtime?
Yeah. So they get this thing, they test it, and it works perfectly. But the first one, it breaks down. And so they have to send some poor sort of, you know, postdoc back into town, back into the red light district, back into the sex shop, and say, I'm really sorry, but after 2 hours of continuous use, my anal vibrator stopped working. Can I have another one? to this day they use anal vibrators and dildos to vibrate their samples.
I think someone heard the Oppenheimer quote, "Now I am become," and just didn't get any further.
Absolutely. You know, the best thing about that quote is he never said it as well. The actual first thing he said was it was Bainbridge, Kenneth Bainbridge, and he said, "Now we're all sons of bitches."
I thought you were going to say the first thing that was said after the first atomic bomb was dropped was, "Ooh, it's a bit shiny, isn't it?" Because apparently Kenneth Williams was there.
I always feel sorry for Bainbridge because his one job when the bomb went off was that if it didn't go off, he had to drive out and poke it to see what was wrong.
He had to literally return to the lit firework.
Exactly. The lit kiloton nuclear bomb firework.
Nowadays, of course, he'd be able to do it from a safe distance with a very long dildo.
Astonishing. I think you've just invented the telescopic dildo.
Yeah. I've not invented that, Ben.
I was gonna say, we're already on the Internet of Things. There are long distance dildos.
I think it was Professor Anne Summers invented that, as far as I'm aware. Kit,
sorry, I've derailed you already.
Kit is a very respected science journalist. Let's be very clear.
Not by the end of this podcast, he isn't.
But we always like to ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. What is that for you?
So, shamelessly, because I am a scientist of sorts, I am the world's worst fire starter. I am a twisted fire starter. So I do not know, as an adult, how to use a lighter. I have never used one. They are magic, as far as I'm concerned. I have never been able to successfully strike a match. I've just damaged the packet, striking it around. Gas hobs scare the crap out of me. I get someone else to do the Bunsen burners. I just cannot start a fire to save my life.
Wow. Was Billy Joel writing about you?
Exactly. I did not start the fire. Of all the people, Billy Joel could probably say that I'm innocent.
You're the only guy not in that list.
The list is a long list when you listen to that song. Yeah. I am not on that song, so...
Yeah,
it's only just occurred to me that the vocalist for the Prodigy on Firestarter was called Keith Flint. So surely all you need to do to start a fire is get his brother and then rub them together, and then you'd get a fire.
Can I give you my favourite chemistry fact first of all?
Please do.
Glass is a liquid, sort of, kind of a little bit.
This feels like you're going to take us through this fact, and then Kit is going to provide us with a number of footnotes.
Well, it's not really liquid, but it's not a solid. Is it called an amorphous solid? Basically, the molecules in glass still flow in the manner that they do in liquids, but they're at a very, very slow rate. So it's pretty much imperceptible. So it doesn't flow fast enough to classify it as a liquid, but because they flow, it's not a solid either. So yeah, chemists call glasses amorphous solids, sort of between a solid and a liquid.
It's really interesting. So when you look at the history of glass planes, because in old churches, there's sort of this gathering of the glass is thicker at the bottom. People often cite that as an example of sort of the amorphous solid flowing. It's not. It's just people were shit at making glass in the Middle Ages, and they just put the lower part first. But, I mean, I've actually done a little bit of work into stained glass windows because the Russians in the 1970s tried to find new elements in stained glass windows. They were convinced that there was an element in the lead around the lining. And so they would go into Orthodox churches and they would run off with the stained glass windows to try and find elements inside the lead. They never succeeded.
Any excuse for the commies to tear up a church?
Yeah, in the interest of science.
They never succeeded. So, you know, but they do have some lovely windows at their lab in Dublin.
Yeah, that's very true. that's just a really nice thing that when you're holding your glass of water, you're kind of holding water inside another liquid. Robert Boyle, I read a bit about Robert Boyle. He's the founder of modern chemistry. He's most famous for Boyle's Law. Which I sort of think it's pressure, gas pressure. The less space gas has to be in, the more pressure builds up, basically. He said less scientifically than I'm sure the law actually states. Although it's not technically Boyle's Law. As with so many facts, this relationship between pressure and volume is first noted by Richard Townley and Henry Power. But Boyle did several experiments and published the results. But there was also a French physicist called Edme Mariot discovered the law without having read Boyle's work a few years later as well. So it's also known, particularly in the French-speaking world, as Mariot's law. I like these... you know, things you think are facts that aren't facts. Like the Hundred Years' War isn't 100 years long. Boyle's Law isn't really Boyle's Law. But the thing I liked most about Boyle is he had a wish list. This is going to be most of my section, by the way. Boyle wrote kind of 27 things, like a Reddit article or a BuzzFeed article, 27 scientific inventions I wish had been invented by Robert Boyle.
Tremendous.
Some of which do kind of exist, and some of which don't, and some of which I feel the need for has diminished since the 1600s. But yeah, I'm just going to read out his wish list. He had the prolongation of life. That feels like we've kind of accomplished that, but that feels like an everlasting wish list throughout human history.
That feels like a very alchemical thing to wish, which was basically looking for the Philosopher's Stone.
Oh yeah, Boyle, like Newton and a lot of other respected scientists, loved a bit of alchemy, to be fair.
There's nothing... to a modernise, there's a lot wrong with that, but actually, at the time, it makes a lot of sense. And I've read a number of books or articles that describe Newton as not the first scientist, but the last alchemist, or even the last magician.
Yeah, alchemy is a really interesting thing when it comes to chemistry, because there are a lot of people who are literally, you know, they've got the long beards, they're doing the astrology, they're trying all that kind of stuff. And in fact, I'll bring up one of those lunatics. But there are also some very good scientists who are, they're basically using code. So a lot of things like, you know, put the fiery dragon's son into the cauldron, all that kind of stuff, is actually them hiding their lab notes. He means, by fiery dragon's son, he means take iron and put it in the, you know, in the cauldron and melt the iron. So it's all just sort of like secret code. So a lot of what alchemy has sort of is actually chemistry. It's just them using secret words.
That's amazing. I love it. Yeah, but that also, I mean, we have people today like, oh, if you apply enough pressure to peanut butter, you can turn it into a diamond. I mean, it doesn't seem that much of a leap.
That's physicists, man. I mean, physicists are weird.
Yeah, I know. But it doesn't seem that far removed from, well, let's try and turn one metal into another metal.
Yeah, you can turn lead into gold. A guy called Glenn Seaborg, who I think you've mentioned previously on the show, he did that in the 1980s. I mean, you get a tiny amount of gold. It's not worth doing, but it is possible.
Yeah, the expense is far greater than the payoff, I think we learned. Yeah.
I feel if there's any breakfast spread that you're going to attempt alchemy with, it should be Marmite.
Marmite?
Yeah, that's probably... I mean, you're either going to get gold or you're going to get shit from it.
Well, Marmite is... full of potassium, so actually you shouldn't. If you concentrate Marmite down and then lob it into a big bucket of water, you've got yourself a bomb.
Thank you, Dr. Vandervelde.
I mean, I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole because but potassium is fantastic, and potassium, sodium, lithium. I mean, that's how I really got into chemistry. That's fun when you do that in the lab. And there's some great videos. They had a load of spare sodium in the 1940s, the US Army, and they couldn't work out what to do with it. And so they just put it in barrels and just dumped it in a lake. And there is video footage on YouTube. I mean, you'll find it really easily, of them just dumping giant barrels of sodium. They roll it down the hill and the lake goes boom. It's fabulous.
That's the most American thing ever.
I was about to
say, we're going
to
blow up a lake.
That is the most Wile E. Coyote description of science I've ever heard, Kit. Roll it down the hill and lake goes boom.
Yeah. Back on Boyle's wish list, he also wished for the recovery of youth, or at least some marks of it, as new teeth, new hair coloured as in youth, false teeth and hair dye. The art of flying... tick. The art of continuing long underwater and exercising functions freely there. Well, you know, we've got scuba. The cure of wounds at a distance. I don't know what the at a distance bit really means. Robotic doctors, I guess. Those, you know, every
means,
time you
he
get
means
those.
A dildo
like...
on a pole, that's what he means.
Yeah. The cure of diseases at a distance, or at least by transplantation. Tick. The attaining gigantic dimensions. Dick. The emulating, I love this. The emulating of fish without engines by custom and education only. He's already done wanting to swim for ages underwater and be able to, you know, move around freely under there, like several notices further earlier, and now he's gone. Just to be clear, when I said I want to be able to swim for ages underwater, I mean I want us to be fish people.
I think he's got a mermaid fetish or something. He's just trying to hit up the mermaids.
Yeah, he 100%
is. He's read too much Paracelsus. He's mistaken Paracelsus for creepy fan fiction.
Fin fiction.
Oh, come on.
The acceleration of the production of things out of seed. We've got sort of forced crops and GM crops and things now. The transmutation of metals. There's our alchemy. The making of glass malleable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, glass is already kind of malleable. The transmutation of species in minerals, animals, and vegetables. The liquid alkahest. Now, people were always on about alkahest at this time. It was a theorized universal solvent where you could dissolve anything, basically, and it would still maintain its basic characteristics. The making of parabolical and hyperbolical glasses. Good lenses. The making armor light and extremely hard, flak jackets. The practicable and certain ways of finding longitudes, that I think we've talked about, the search for compasses and all of those things that took place. The use of pendulums at sea and in journeys and the application of it to watches. Grandfather clocks. Robert Boyle loves a grandfather clock, it turns out. Potent drugs to alter or exalt imagination, waking, memory and other functions.
Oh yes, please, someone wants a little bit of...
ayahuasca. Yeah. A ship to sail with all winds... because obviously still dealing with sailing at the time, mm-hmm. So we can now sail against the winds. And a ship not to be sunk, the Titanic. Freedom from necessity of much sleeping, exemplified by the operations of tea and what happens in Mad Men.
Oh, so someone wants some Benzedrine as well.
Yeah, most of these, to be fair, we've sort of, in one way or another, dealt with a lot of them. Pleasing dreams and physical exercises, exemplified by the Egyptian electuary and by the fungus mentioned by the French author.
He just wants to go to an underwater rave. That is all this is.
He really... yes. Well, you've made it so clear. He asked for great strength and agility of body and a perpetual light. He just wants, you know, glow sticks and, you know, to dance all night. And this final one, varnishes perfumable by rubbing.
This is exactly it. He wants the mermaid honeys and he wants with Sebastian the crab having a great time.
I think the varnish is perfumable by rubbing is probably some sort of scratch and sniff invention. But Boyle isn't my worst chemist, and I'm also going to discount. There is a myth about Margaret Thatcher. There's a story, certainly, about Margaret Thatcher. Because she was a chemist. She studied chemistry at Somerville College, Oxford, and worked as a research chemist for Joe Lyons from 1949 to 51. She worked developing emulsifiers for ice creams. The New Scientist reported this in 1983 as she was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society. And the Washington Post, after her death, wrote that she helped invent ice cream as we know it. And there is a story that she helped invent Mr. Whippy, and particularly on the left, people like saying that she, you know, made it cheaper and put more air into it so there was less ice cream, and it was Maggie Thatcher, milk snatcher all over again, but with ice cream. But Mr. Whippy soft serve ice cream had been in the USA for at least a decade before Margaret Thatcher worked for J. Lyons. And when soft serve arrived in the UK, certainly J. Lyons was the company leading it. But they worked with the US company Mr. Softy and operated franchises under that name. So they didn't really need Thatcher's input, so to speak. So there's no firm evidence. While she did work on helping, you know, make cake and pie fillings, as well as working with ice cream and soap making, there's no evidence that she directly insisted in the invention of Mr. Whippy ice cream, or indeed the 99 flake. No, she did close down the flake mines in the 80s. But my choice for the world's worst chemist is a woman called Annie Duken. Now, ooh. Annie Duken, which is not a thing someone shouts in Street Fighter. Annie Duken was born in 1977. She's an American convicted felon, which is the first line of her Wikipedia page. She worked as a chemist at the Massachusetts Department of Public Health Drug Abuse Lab. Now, she attended Regis College, then earned a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Massachusetts, Boston in 2001, which is not the same as the University of Massachusetts, to be very clear. Yet that did not stop her putting UMass on her CV.
Oh dear, got some real Oxford Brookes vibes going on.
Oh yes. And during her time working at the state lab, she also claimed to be attending night classes as part of a PhD program at Harvard University. This also was not true. And in 2003, she was hired as a chemist at the Hinton State Laboratory Institute in the Jamaica Plain neighborhood in Boston. Now, 8 years later, in 2011, an evidence officer at the lab discovered that Duken had tested 95 samples without properly signing them out. And they investigated a bit further, and they found she had forged the initials of an evidence officer in her logbook, and she was suspended. And eventually she resigned in 2012 when she was brought to court. A probe revealed that her superiors had ignored loads of red flags around her behaviour for ages. She had reportedly, during her career, tested over 500 samples per month. The normal, average scientist working in her lab would test about 100 samples per month. So she said she had claimed she had been testing five times as many as the rest of her colleagues.
So she's hardworking, she's efficient, I don't see the problem.
Even though her supervisors and colleagues claim to have never seen her in front of a microscope.
Okay.
In 2011, police interviewed her at her home, and she admitted to altering and faking test results in order to cover up her frequent dry labbing. That's visually identifying samples without actually testing them. She even went so far as to add cocaine to samples where there was no cocaine previously present. She said she'd be doing this for up to 3 years and broke down to the police saying, I messed up bad. I don't want the lab to get in trouble. In 2013, she was sentenced to 3 to 5 years in prison, 2 years probation by Judge Carol S. Ball, who wrote, innocent persons were incarcerated, guilty persons have been released to further endanger the public. Millions and millions of public dollars are being expended to deal with the chaos Ms. Dukin created, and the integrity of the criminal justice system has been shaken to the core. In May 2015, the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled that defendants whose convictions on drug charges were based on evidence potentially tainted by Dukin could all pursue retrials without having to face more charges or tougher sentences. In 2017, Massachusetts dropped more than 21,000 low-level drug criminal charges involving her. Out of the 15,570 cases in which she was involved, only 117 would be pursued, according to the District Attorney of Suffolk County. And in theory, there are probably 34,000 to 40,000 cases were affected and contaminated by her basically looking at a slide and going, yeah, that's probably cocaine. Next slide, please.
So what was her justification for this? Just that she wanted lots of people incarcerated, or she couldn't be bothered to do her job properly, or?
It seems like she just didn't have the qualifications for it, and they would have had loads of, you know, pressure and backlogs in the lab. And she just decided to take matters into her own hands and speed up the process. Yeah, she was, unsurprisingly, because this is how the world works these days, her story was the subject of a Netflix series in 2020, How to Fix a Drug Scandal, because literally nothing can happen in the news these days without Netflix optioning the headline.
Oh, mate, I went down to Sainsbury's this morning and Netflix has already optioned that.
Yeah. So I just like that she's affected so many cases, like tens of thousands of court cases and investigations, all tainted by her. Obviously, if she'd looked at the court cases, she wouldn't have noticed that they were tainted by her in the first place. She wouldn't have seen traces of herself in it. And the fact that she, you know, claimed she'd gone to University of Massachusetts, not, as you basically suggest, the Polytechnic next door. But that her supervisors had, like, said, we'd never seen her in front of a microscope. She had even frequently misidentified samples, apparently. And they hadn't gone, you know what, maybe we should look into what she's getting up to.
I mean, I feel like the world's worst chemist is not her, but her supervisors.
Yeah. She's not necessarily incompetent. You know, as if she'd applied herself, maybe she'd have gotten quite good. I just like the fact that she basically went in for speed chemistry.
Very good indeed. Literally speed chemistry in some cases, I imagine.
Not that she'd have noticed.
So I've gone for sort of bronze, silver, and gold. And rather than go for an incompetent, kind of gone for perverts. I'll be honest. Winner is both a pervert and an incompetent chemist. So for bronze, I have gone probably upset a lot of chemists. I've gone for Dmitry Mendeleev. I know, the founder
wow,
of the periodic
a sacred
table.
Cow.
So Dmitry Mendeleev, for those who don't know, if you've seen the periodic table, he's the guy that came up with the version we use. He's on the periodic table. He's element 101, Mendelevium. And it's got nothing to do with his abilities as a chemist that I picked him, and more to do with his marital life. So Dmitry Mendeleev... He had an interesting experience growing up. He grew up in Siberia, and his parents, he was the descendant of a Tatar princess, an unnamed Tatar princess. This was complete garbage. And so he kind of had this weird entitlement growing up. He went to university in St. Petersburg. He gets tuberculosis, and he thinks, I'm going to rest up. I'm going to find...
Is TB on the periodic table?
TB, there is a terbium on the periodic table.
Yes,
but sadly he didn't get this. So he gets tuberculosis, and he thinks, I'm going to find a relaxing career somewhere nice and quiet. And so for a career, he chooses to be a teacher, because everyone knows teaching is incredibly relaxing. And he decides the best place to go on holiday is the Crimea. This is 4 months after the Battle of Balaclava, and a week after he starts his teaching position, 30,000 French troops invade his village. So,
oh my God!
This is the kind of guy we're dealing with. But after he becomes famous with the periodic table,
because other people were trying to sort out the chemical elements at the time, weren't they?
And this is something that's been going on since about a guy during the French Revolution. He was, again, an interesting chap. Married a 13-year-old.
What was his name? Sorry.
So he was
Lavoisier. Yeah,
he's a sort of a very major figure in chemistry, and he was really the first guy to try and make a list of stuff that you can't simplify any further. And some of them he got right. Mm. You know, he put things like iron down. He also thought calories and light were elements. He didn't quite get it. quite get it perfect. Anyway, so Mendeleev, he does this thing, but he also keeps up with his teaching, and he is teaching a teenage girl. And he falls madly in love with her, which is never a good sign. And so the teacher starts writing love letters. The family find out, and they take the girl to Rome in Italy to get him away, because he's in St. Petersburg. And Mendeleev follows her. He goes to Rome. Ooh. He presents himself at her doorstep, and he says, unless you marry me, I'm going to kill myself. And so she's like, oh, no, Dmitri, don't do this. They go back to Russia. And he bribes a priest, and they marry. Why does he bribe a priest? Because Dmitri Mendeleev was already married. He was a bigamist. He is the only bigamist on the periodic table. He was actually in a process of divorcing his wife, but in Russia you have to wait a certain period of time. He just didn't bother with that. And the Tsar famously said, Dmitri Mendeleev may have two wives, but I only have one Dmitri Mendeleev. So yeah. Dmitri Mendeleev, bigamist. Have I just shattered?
I mean, often on this podcast, famous man equals shit in massive shocker is not as massive shocker as you might imagine. But yeah, that's a hell of a backstory.
Well, yeah, later on in life as well, he has this weird adventure in a balloon. He wants to go and see the eclipse up close. There's an eclipse in Russia. And the army give him a balloon and they're going to take him up. And for some reason, he decides that he doesn't want the guy who knows how to fly a balloon and throws him out and takes off in a balloon after his eclipse and can't get down and ends up just sort of drifting across Russia for a bit in a balloon with everyone going, look, there's Dmitri Mendeleev. How's he going to get down? So he's a weird, weird man. But he's in bronze. Silver, I have gone for John Whiteside's Parsons, a.k.a. Parsons. And I should just put a disclaimer, I love Jack Parsons. I can talk about Jack Parsons a very, very long time. But he's awful. So Parsons grew up in the early 20th century in Los Angeles. He was born in 1914 to a wealthy family. And in the 20s, he's picked up a pen pal, which by 1939, and they both sum up his life. So the first is the Nazi Wernher von Braun. Who I think is a friend of the show.
Almost certainly.
Yes, we do enjoy a bit of Wernher von Braun.
And the other is the British occultist Aleister Crowley. So
absolutely a friend of the show.
We are talking about a chemist who loves sex magic. We'll start off with the rocket. And he wants to blast off into space. He's constantly getting in trouble for blowing shit up. His family get hit hard in the Depression. He has to drop out of Stanford, and he starts hanging out with some guys at the Guggenheim Aeronautical. And they're basically a bunch of reprobates. They're known as the Suicide Squad. And Parsons is their bomb maker. He makes nitroglycerin at home on the front porch. He pawns his wife's. He gets in a job and it explodes his manufacturer. In 1938, he's practically making chemicals that go exploding. That he is an expert witness in the trial of an LAPD captain who was a bomb on another officer's car. And that kind of makes Parsons famous. Anyway, by the Second War, the Second World War, this group that they've sent off, they're called Galsit, they're now for the US government. And so he's become quite important. So that's during the day. The thing is, by 1939, he has a new interest, which is casting spells with his cock. So he becomes a person, essentially, which is Aleister Crowley's religion. And he sets up a sex cult in a house in Pasadena, which he calls the Parsonage. Up to, you know, the usual hijinks. Pregnant women leap through fire, rituals to summon poltergeists. There are orgies. Parsons is taking every drug he can get his hands on. The dude is a junkie. He's sleeping with everyone, including his wife's sister, Sarah, his best friend's wife, who later has an abortion and the best friend leaves him. It's all going very crazy. And at this point, Parsons has to make a call because the FBI have been called on him for him running a black magic cult. And they've been giving him kind of leading their jet propulsion research. But they're worried about having a rocket expert who is also a devil worshipper, ritualistic spunk cocks on their rocket. So Parsons gets paid off and he quits Galsit. And Galsit very shortly afterwards changes its name to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which today is NASA. Parsons is listed as one of the founders of NASA. But he's got the sex cult. So he picks black magic and he becomes a major figure. And at this time, a guy comes to the parsonage to stay called L. Ron Hubbard.
Yes!
Parsons and Hubble.
Yes, of course it is. I suddenly remembered how this story ends. I suddenly realised who this guy is.
Yeah, so Parsons and Hubble, they get along and they decide to do this ritual. It's a 3-month ritual where Parsons goes into the desert and has a wank all day while Hubbard watches. And at the end of a giant desert masturbation session, Parsons decides he has magically somehow summoned a scarlet woman who will give him a moon child. He goes back home. There's a redhead on the doorstep called Marjorie. He becomes obsessed with her. And while he's having this time with Marjorie and he's having difficulties with his wife, Hubbard and they basically try and defraud him. They borrow money and they're going to buy three yachts and sail from Florida to the West Panama Canal. Parsons ends up chasing them to Florida to try and get his money back. And they've sailed off on a yacht. And they're outside a rocket range for him. So he does the only other thing he can. He whips his cock out and he wank up a hurricane. And
did you say wank up hurricane?
I did say wank up a hurricane. And bizarrely, this works.
No, it doesn't. Comes. Shut the fuck up,
Hubbard is forced back to port. And Parsons is like, yeah, magic, bitches. He loves it. Parsons ends up in court with L. Ron Hubbard. All of it. Obviously, Hubbard and Sarah then go off to found the Church of Scientology. Parsons, he has a bit of difficulties. I say him at this point. Marjorie, the Scarlet Woman, isn't too happy either. He ends up communist and an Israeli spy.
That's quite a CV.
It is. In 1952, he's got no other option. He returns to chemistry. He's got a little lab in his garage. And at this point, no one's really sure what happens. It looks like he was trying to mix fulminate of mercury, which is an incredibly dangerous substance, in a coffee tin. The tin explodes and it takes up all the other chemicals with atoms. And he just sort of evaporates in this giant explosion in his garage. So Parsons is blown to smithereen and thus ends someone with a magic penis who gave us both NASA and Scientology.
That is... And he's not your Wordsworth Kennedy.
That is silver.
I'm sorry, that is pure gold. That is amazing.
So are you ready for gold?
Yes, please.
So I have picked a chap called Hennig Brand.
Hennig Brand.
And in 1669, Hennig Brand discovered phosphorus. And that was really important because it was the first element discovered since about 200 AD when Indians discovered zinc. So it's the first real modern element. What is not usually, he discovered phosphorus while trying to turn his own piss into gold. So Brand didn't have much money, and buying all of these scientists in the 1600s was incredibly. So what he did was he married and he bankrupted his wife buying. The wife dies, succeeded in, you know, he's in his philosopher's stone, and so the second rich widow, and he starts working through her fortune as well, much to the consternation of her son.
Oh my god!
So he's working his way through two women at the moment, and he is convinced that he can turn his pee pee into gold. Never mind the philosopher's stone. He's working with his cock.
And just to be clear, he's trying to do it once it's outside the body, right?
Yes. So it's estimated that in the process of all this, in his basement, he stockpiles 1,500 gallons of his own urine, which is the equivalent of 3,800, you know, liter and a half Coke bottles of piss.
So, okay, just a quick back of the fag packet maths. That is, 3,800 half liter bottles. So that's a good, probably 2 years worth of pissing.
There's a lot of piss in his basement. Let's not beat around the bush here. There is a lot of piss. And he succeeds. No, he doesn't. So one day he's basically making a pot of piss tea. He boils it up and he notices and starts glowing, the residue. It gives off this gas, and then it gives a liquid that glows slightly. And spoilers, this is isolated phosphorus from urine, because there is a small amount of it in there. He, by accident, he's not trying to make phosphorus at all. He's trying to get wealthy. Rather than tell people about this, he keeps it a secret. He's like, I'm going to hoard my dirty little pee-pee secret. He's worried that someone else will get luminous pee squirt fortune. I don't know. So he hoards the recipe. And it's only after he sells it to a friend for 200 thaler, which is about a month's wages back then in Germany, that we actually find out the recipe. Would you like to know Brand's recipe of how to make your wee into magical glow juice?
Go for it.
So, first of all, let the urine stand for days until it gives off a pungent smell. I should point out this step is completely unnecessary. Phosphorus count. At all. You could just use fresh urine. He was just a weird perv. You take the urine and you boil it, got a thick syrup. Then you heat it, heat a red oil. You take that away and you allow things to cool. So you've now got a black, spongy upper part and a salty lower
part. Delicious.
Discard the salt. Yeah, absolutely. You discard the salt, you mix the red back into the black material for 16 hours, and voila, white fumes begin to come. Phosphorus. The thing is, this is a terrible, terrible way to make phosphorus. From his, you know, 3,800 litres of, you know, Coke bottles of piss or whatever, he makes a whopping 120 grams of phosphorus. He should have been making about 700 times that much. So Hennig Brand is a gold digger who hoarded 3,800 Coke bottles of piss in his basement. Somehow, with a staggeringly naff recipe, accidentally makes something that he wasn't even trying to do, didn't know what it was, and never told anybody until his mate bought him off.
Oh, dear. I mean, a literal and indeed awful piss artist. In fact, not a piss artist, a piss scientist. That's where he was going wrong.
Oh my god. I love all of those.
Was taking the piss.
Yeah.
To start with, we're going to go talk about a gentleman who was a very talented chemist, perhaps one of the most talented chemists of the 20th century, a man called Gilbert Newton Lewis. He was... Kit has just made the universally recognised wanker sign, and I think we're going to find out why in a moment. He, the Dean of the College of Chemistry at Berkeley, he was known for the discovery of the covalent bond and the concept of electron pairs, which is, I mean, it's GCSE level chemistry there, as far as, not to demean it, as in something so fundamental that he's discovered, and a whole world of other contributions to the world of chemical thermodynamics, photochemistry, and isotope separation. He also researched relativity and quantum physics, and even coined the term photon for the smallest unit of radiant energy. Why then, gentlemen, am I suggesting that he is the world's worst chemist, or at least one of the nominees for it? Well, because he was nominated for the Nobel Prize for Chemistry 41 times and never won it.
And that's amazing.
As far as I can see, it is because of a long-standing beef with one of his tutors at Harvard, Walter Nernst, who disliked him so much that he continued to get in the way of him winning a Nobel Prize.
That is in essence it. Renowned asshole.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're about to go into details of some of the things he did, but yeah. He didn't win the Nobel because nobody liked him.
Yeah, but that also reminds me of, I think we've mentioned on the show before, that I think Angela Lansbury was nominated for an Emmy for Murder, She Wrote for 12 consecutive seasons and didn't win any of them.
Is Angela Lansbury also a noted
dickhead?
Yeah,
no.
Here's the thing, I couldn't find the reasons why people disliked him. Other than, as far as I could find, it was just an academic rivalry that spiraled out of hand.
Oh,
I don't know whether kids...
No, it wasn't. You can... So Gilbert Newton Lewis, his party trick, if you will, is that when someone gave a chemistry lecture, he would light a cigar, and for the duration of time it took him to finish smoking the cigar, he would tell them why they are a shit chemist, why everything they said was wrong, and why they're just an awful human being. He would just insult them for the entire length of his cigar smoking. So he was a massive knobhead. He was also incredibly There is a case in the 1940s where there was an incredibly talented undergraduate at Berkeley called Margaret Melhay. She, as an undergraduate, discovered cesium-137, which is an incredibly important isotope. And Gilbert Newton Lewis actually refused her access and an entry into the PhD program. Once had a woman do a PhD, and then she went and had a child and got married and wasted her entire education. That was his justification. So he's a misogynist, he was an asshole, and his death is quite spectacular as well, which I think Ben's probably going to come on to.
Well, his death was that it was probably suicide, but he met up with his nemesis for lunch and then returned to his laboratory after playing what I've read as an incredibly moody game of bridge, and then was found dead in the laboratory an hour later. And it is suggested that the stacking up of runners-up for the Nobel Prize, or being reminded of this by meeting his former tutor, was the tipping point to his death. Is there any more to it than that, Kit?
That is essentially it. I mean, I understand that it was him not winning the Nobel and one of his arch rivals actually winning that set him off. Mm. And he has this meet, goes into the lab, and I think it's cyanide, isn't it? It sort of leaks and he's found dead. The idea is basically he just couldn't, the fact that he was that no one liked him. He had no friends. But yeah, truly an awful man, and that's why he didn't have friends. Glenn Seaborg was actually one of his doctoral students. Yeah. He studied under Jan Lewis before moving into nuclear chemistry. But in his biography, you know, yes, he was my mentor, but you know, he did have some, with just about anyone he worked with.
Yeah, he was. So, as in terms of bad people, he's right there. Next, this is quite a sad story than a happy story. This is a chap called Douglas C. Prasher, He was a molecular biologist, but also worked in the world of chemistry as well. In 2008, three other men, Osamu Shimomura, Martin Chalfy, and Roger Y. Tien, all were awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for their work on green fluorescent protein. Prasher was the fourth contributor to that. However, he wasn't allowed to have the Nobel Prize for a couple of reasons. One, because if you're in a team, the maximum team size is three for the Nobel Prize. Bit like when you run a pub quiz, any team over six, then you have to stop. Just house rules. But secondly, in 1991, Prasher communicated a key idea as part of the green fluorescent protein thesis to Chalfy and Tien. By 1991, he was unable to obtain further research funding and left academia.
Oh.
He sort of spiraled down and down through the tiers of academia. He worked for a while at the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service as part of the American Department of Agriculture. He worked as a population geneticist in Cape Cod. And by the time the award was given, he was working as a shuttle bus driver for a Toyota dealership for $8.50 an hour. One of his former colleagues called this situation a staggering waste of talent. Prasher stated that he really wished he'd resume a career in science, although he specified not with jellyfish, because clearly at some point on his descent downwards through the tiers, he had worked in ocean sciences and clearly taken a dislike to jellyfish. He was very magnanimous towards the three men who won the Nobel Prize, and all three of the laureates thanked him in their speeches, and he was allowed, and they invited him to attend the awards as their guest of honour. And it has a happy ending. In 2010, he was able to return to science, working for Streamline Automation in Huntsville, and then later in the labs of Tien at the University of California. But in terms of, you know, not losing 20 years of his life almost because he couldn't get the funding because the world of science wasn't able to recognize what a great mind he has. It's quite a tragic story. Yeah.
I thought we were going to go down Breaking Bad then. I thought he was going to, you know, he got cancer and he started becoming a drug dealer. Yeah. Or something like that.
Is that going to... I wish that had been the case.
I was going to say, I actually met Martin Chalfy once. We were in a Bavarian beer garden, and I think he was a little bit worse for wear, and he was wearing sort of, you know, the lederhosen. Anyway, I actually asked him to do something for me, and I emailed him about it a month later, and he said that he had no recollection of meeting me or agreeing to do this or even being in that beer garden. So it's an interesting team he's with, but I liked Martin, but yeah.
Oh, good. I'm glad he's a good guy. But for my choice, we are going to Italy in the 1920s, always a morally dubious time and place. And we're going to talk about a gentleman called Luigi Rolla, who worked in the University of Florence. This is a time when there were still quite notable gaps in the periodic table. Quite a lot of the elements, I say quite a lot, there were five or six elements in the middle block of the table that had yet to be discovered. And Rolla was trying to discover element 61. And he thought he had discovered it. The hunt for these elements had been going on really since the start of the 20th century. The missing elements were 43, 61, 72, 75, 85, 87... Bingo. In 1919, Rolla was the chair of general chemistry at the University of Florence, and he was working under Jacobus Henricus van 't Hoff, who is of no consequence to us, and a little gentleman called Walter Nernst, nemesis of Gilbert Lewis.
They're all so interconnected, I love it.
Yeah. And from the start, the researchers believed that the element they were looking for would be found in Brazilian monazite sands, but it would be in such small quantities that it could scarcely be extracted, which is very often the case with some of the rarer elements. And by spring 1924, his team thought they were ready to announce that they had photographed the characteristic X-ray spectrum of element 61, which they were going to call fluorentium, because obviously University of Florence and a lot of chemists are clearly egomaniacs, present company accepted, until chapmanium.
Yeah.
Roller at this stage was assailed by doubt, and there's this real issue, I guess, for all scientists of, do I go public and say, we've discovered it without absolutely nailing down the proofs, or do we wait but risk being scooped by someone else, because lots of different teams were searching for this. In June 1924, he delivered a sealed envelope to the Accademia dei Lincei, containing a sample of the new alleged element and the results of the analysis, and the package was to remain a secret until he or other chemists brought forth real concrete evidence of the existence of this element. A senator at the time called Felice Benza was fascinated by this story, and he donated 1 million liras to the University of Florence for the purpose of obtaining monazite. In autumn 1925, Rolla began to isolate what he believed was the missing element, and he spent this million lira essentially turning the first floor of the chemistry laboratory there into an industrial lab. Meanwhile, in America, at the University of Illinois, three chemists, B. Smith Hopkins, J. Allen Harris, and Leonard Intema, announced their own discovery of element 61. And their team had used the same element as Rolla, and they coined this new element illinium. And this discovery was confirmed by some other English and German researchers. And obviously, Rolla felt awful that he had been scooped. And so he asked the people at the Accademia to break the seals of the envelope that he had given to them, like a sort of Derren Brown trick. At a formal sitting of the Accademia, Rolla stood up and addressed the gathered scientists there to say that he deserved priority in this case. And he sort of warmed the audience up, saying, we're going to make a sensational announcement about this. And Italy being Italy at this time, they were fanning the flames of nationalism about this, partially because Mussolini's going to Mussolini, and also because Italy and America at this time were at loggerheads because of two Italian-American anarchists, Niccolò Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, were awaiting execution for both spying and, I believe, acts of terrorism in America. Now, in 1927, with all of the questions about whether this element had been discovered up in the air, he sailed to America to see what the Americans had found. And on the way back to Italy, he popped into Copenhagen, where Niels Bohr, one of the greatest physicists of all time, lived. And while he was there, he used Bohr's equipment and laboratory to do spectroscopic examination on his sample, and it left them no room for doubt. He didn't have the element. He had made up an element. And in a letter addressed to one of his colleagues, Rita Brunetti, Rolla wrote, "Dear Miss Professor, in the samples you analysed and that you affirmed the existence of element 61, there is nothing."
What was in his envelope then? Something that wasn't just a new element.
Yeah, exactly. Just some Brazilian sand. However, even though the results were disheartening, because he believed his American colleagues were going to reach their goal first, he still went ahead and announced it. He had an assistant by the name of Fernandez, and in summer 1928, this assistant convinced Rolla to publish a retraction of fluorentiums, going, "Mate, you've been scooped, it's not yours." And in response, Rolla forbade the young man to mention the negative results to anyone. And this disagreement between Rolla and his assistant led to the assistant's dismissal in 1930. Indeed, Rolla accused his former student of a series of nasty manipulative activities: negligence, working for third parties, exploiting university resources, damaging the X-ray equipment, and even committing acts of sabotage. And Fernandez went to the rector of the university for support, but what's the rector of the university going to do? Am I going to support a long-standing professor of the university in Rolla, or this young upstart? Well, considering that this rector, Enrico Burchi, was quite a fan of Mussolini and fascism, there was no choice at all. He relieved Fernandez of his tenure at university and supported the fraudulent Rolla. But Fernandez, when he sought new employment in Milan, said, "I have already been hired by a company when, on the eve of my transfer, Professor Rolla blew up my accommodation. He continues to defame me everywhere and with everyone." He decided to sue Rolla, and Florentian became the object, no longer of the chemical bench, but of that tribunal. And Rolla was depicted as a traitor who tried to hide from the scientific world the failure of his alleged discovery. But sadly, in the end, the verdict favoured Rolla. Despite all of his crimes, both scientific and, I guess, moral, and Rolla sort of hid in his role at the university and with support of fascism. My favourite thing about the denouement is this. At last, in 1941, Rolla admitted to the fraudulence of Element 61. He admitted to this, not in an Italian publication, not in a German one, not in an American one or an English one, but in the Pontificia Accademia Scientiarum. That's right. In a minor scientific journal of the Vatican State. And he admitted to it in Latin. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So, our suggestions for the world's worst chemist are Barry's suggestion of the worst seasoner of samples ever, Annie Duken, Kit's suggestion of the piss scientist Hennig Brand, and my suggestion of the fascist defamer and discoverer of a non-existent element of Florentium, Luigi Rolla. It's tricky because I think the correct answer is Jim Parsons.
Yeah. not Jim Parsons,
sorry,
Jack Parsons.
Not Jim Parsons.
Jim Parsons is a physicist, if I remember correctly.
No, Jim Parsons is not a physicist. That is sort of the point of his job. Gosh, it's really difficult to work this out because, I mean, morally, Annie Duken is the worst. The actual human cost is thousands of people in jail, as far as I can see. Hennig Brand was barely a chemist because of the time that he lived in, but he was just terrible at the scientific process. And Luigi Rolla was the kind of guy who is a classic arrogant scientist who just didn't want to back down under any circumstances.
It's a real worst foot forward sort of bag of cliches there, isn't it?
It is. I dislike mine immensely. He seems like an awful man. And when I first discovered him, I thought it would be a definite winner because it was man discovers thing that doesn't exist, and that felt like a very sort of February 30th kind of metric. But I think I'm going to discount him because sometimes as a scientist you're going to get things wrong. It's just a shame that he wouldn't admit it and then decided to take down one of his fellow colleagues. And Hennig Brand, I love, and I've got a huge amount of time for essentially alchemists who are on the very edges of science. But I just think because she did such awful things in the laboratory and at such great human cost, I'm infuriated by Annie Duken. Yeah. So I think I'm going to say that she is this week's winner.
Yay! We're going to preface all of that by saying, because Thomas Midgley has been on the show twice before already, we had discounted him in advance before anyone tweets us or at us or emails us saying, "Why didn't you pick this guy?" We actually sent Kit a reminder, an email saying, "FYI, you don't need to talk about him."
Junior, and ignored because on one hand, with the Haber-Bosch process, on the other, and was really really pleased about it.
He is a bit dull. Well, and also there are a number of other nominees for World's Worst Chemist that are really very deeply
comedy
dull,
podcast. Comedy podcast.
Absolutely. Before we go, it is time for the world's best news of the week. And we go to Texas, where lollipop man Thomas Fawcett, a veteran of World War II, has celebrated his 100th birthday while still in the job.
Do we have to clarify, do they call them lollipop men in America, or do they call them crossing guards?
No, they could. It says, well, in the article I am reading, albeit in a British newspaper, it says lollipop. Sure. Man. Now, listen, to be fair.
He's not an old man that goes around giving lollipops.
No, that is a very different story starring Timothy Chalamet, I believe. now, I admit, I don't know whether this is a celebration of a man who is still contributing to his local community at the age of 100, or a sad story about the lack of social security and welfare in America.
Or it's a school with loads of students and they haven't finished crossing yet.
He actually took up the job 2 years after retiring from his job at the post office and has kept going since. And it is calculated that he has helped 1 million crosses occur in that time, helping children travel 1,725 miles across the road.
That's cute.
And it's really cute, isn't it? And he seems like a lovely guy.
Yeah, he helped 1 million chickens.
And also, he really doesn't look 100 years old. I mean, we're all marvelling at the footage of William Shatner going into space, looking like he's 70 whilst being 90. Mm. But, like, this guy, again, looks terrific. He was gifted with a giant card, a T-shirt with the slogan, 100 never looked so good, and $100 in cash that the children collected in coins, which, I'll be honest, seems a little underwhelming. Yeah. But nevertheless, he is... a happy man. And the school principal, Ashley Triplett, who organised the celebration, said, rain, sleet, snow, ice, anything at all, he is out there. And I would like to add, as an asterisk to that, you, Ms. Triplett, are going to be a contributor to his death from pneumonia. But nevertheless...
He's out there. He's out there for doing this job for ages, and they give him £100. I want a house. I live at this crossing.
Oh, God, almost certainly. Before we go, Kit, where can our listeners find you and what they find you doing when we get there?
You can find me on Twitter at ChemistryKit, just to garbage and some kind of science history stuff as well occasionally. And my book, Racing Green, comes out in March in 2022. So, you know, see me talk about it there.
Tremendous stuff. We are all off to decant our entire bodily fluids into a collection of jars in the hope of finding element 119. Until next time, goodbye.